U.S. Israeli threats against Iran and the geopolitics of World War III. I'm going to be talking about four distinct subjects, and in a kind of accelerating way. The first one is media deceptions, and because I'm going to be referring to some quite precise textual details, I'll be reading a good chunk of that. I'll then move on to the question of the economic and political instabilities that make war tempting for the United States and Israel. I'll be much briefer there, and of course more speculative. I'll have a little bit to say on a third subject, the likely plans of attack and defense should there be a war. And fourthly, I'll have a little bit to say about the geopolitics that again are at play. I want to start with a quotation from someone I think who could be described as a kind of intellectual hero of our time, Julian Assange, who in a recent interview with Rolling Stone magazine said, quote, "I believe that if we look at what makes a civilization civilized, it is people understanding what is really going on. All human systems require authority, but authority must be granted as a result of the informed consent of the governed. Presently, the consent, if there is any, is not informed, and therefore it's not legitimate." So, media deceptions. My subject is an alarming one, the possibility, some analysts would say, the growing likelihood that American and Israeli threats of war against Iran will lead in short order not just to open war in the Middle East, I think there's a covert war that's already going on, that's very clear, but to great power conflict as well. I don't intend to make rash predictions, but the possibility of an expanding war is one that should be taken very seriously. My point of entry will be an analysis of current aggressive propaganda in the United States. But the words I've quoted from investigative journalist Julian Assange's recent interview with Rolling Stone suggest that it might be useful to begin with some reflexive questions about the state of our own collective self-knowledge. How much do Canadians understand of the goings-on of our own government here at home, let alone in Haiti or Afghanistan or Libya, three countries in which our armed forces have openly intervened during the past decade? Can the Canadian interventions in those countries be fairly described as, in Assange's word, civilized? And in what sense can we be said to have consented to them? Did we consent to, were we even told about, the very large-scale participation of Canadian naval units in the 2003 war against Iraq? Have we been consulted as to their likely participation in the impending war on Iran? We're ruled in this country by a majority government, elected last May by 40% of the 60% of the electorate who voted. How informed was the consent of that not quite 25% of the electorate? If the electorate as a whole has been deceived, misinformed, or simply deflected from relevant truths, what degree of legitimacy could the consent of even a much larger percentage confer upon governing authorities? And what then, in parentheses, of the United States, where many citizens find the acknowledged truthiness of Stephen Colbert, John Stewart, and The Onion preferable to the mendacity of mainstream news sources, and where the formal process of obtaining consent, marked as it is by unconstrained power of corporate money over the electoral process, as well as by massive and systematic right-wing electoral fraud, has become openly farcical. In what we're still pleased to call democracies, consent to the degree it may exist is manufactured. We learned that lesson a quarter century ago, if we didn't know it already, from Edward Herman's and Noam Chomsky's classic, Manufacturing Consent. Chomsky and Herman explained the manufacture of consent through what they call a propaganda model, whose basic transaction, and this is counterintuitive, is the sale of audiences or readerships by news corporations to their advertisers. Within a system in which the information stream undergoes multiple filterings by structures of concentrated and interlocking corporate ownership, by corporate advertisers who may well be among the owners, by government and corporate agencies whose massive output of propaganda scripts, videos, press releases, and not-for-attribution interviews provides a major part of the content which the media purvey as news. By disciplinary structures, including organizations and foundations devoted to enforcing ideological conformity, and finally, more diffusely, by the institutionalized ideology of anti-communism. They were writing in the late 1980s. This is, of course, supplanted since 2001 by the overlapping neo-imperial ideology of the so-called War on Terror. Robert McChesney, who's a leading contemporary scholar of media analysis, has described the period from the 1950s to the 1970s as a golden age of professional journalism in the United States, a time when journalists had relative autonomy and considerable resources to pursue their craft. Now, that autonomy, those resources, are by and large long gone. And there may be some irony if we think of the fact that a very large proportion of the Chomsky-Herman book, Manufacturing Consent, is devoted to testing of their propaganda model with detailed case studies of the ways in which, during those same golden year decades, the corporate media worked in support of American aggressions in Indochina. But Robert McChesney, of course, understands very well the ways in which corporate media have been used to facilitate wars of aggression. He remarked, for example, that during the weeks leading up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, a mere 3% of American sources appearing on U.S. television news were opposed to the war, while more than 70% were decidedly pro-war. During the 3 weeks after the invasion, the ratio of pro to anti-war sources on NBC, ABC, CBS, PBS, CNN, and Fox was 25-1. In discussing what he calls the asininity of much of what passes for contemporary political journalism, McChesney writes, in January 2008, a comprehensive study by the nonpartisan Center for Public Integrity determined that there were fully, and they counted this up, 935 lies, with several hundred coming from President Bush and Vice President Cheney, told to the American people to generate popular support for a war in Iraq. These weren't gray area statements, as the CPI's, Center for Public Integrity's, detailed database makes clear, nor were they oversights or clumsy missteps. As the report concludes, the lies, quote, were part of an orchestrated campaign that effectively galvanized public support, public opinion, and in the process led the nation to war under distinctly false pretenses. Now, two recent incidents can give some measure both of the major corporate media's continuing decline from any supposed watchdog function into what one might call stenographic propaganda, and also of the mounting pressures to purge participants in the new electronic media who might aspire to take up a more critical stance. Here's the first one. January 12, 2002, New York Times public editor, that's a kind of ombudsman, the Toronto Star has a public editor who fills the same function, Arthur Brisbane, asked for, quote, reader input on whether and when New York Times reporters should challenge, in his own quotes, facts that are asserted by newsmakers they write about. Now, the title of his article, Should the Times Be a Truth Vigilante, suggested that any such challenge would be improper. He got more input back than he'd expected. Quote, when did truth-telling and fact-checking become novel ideas? Demanded one blogger. Glenn Greenwald at Salon.com proposed putting Brisbane's words, quote, on the wall of a museum to explain contemporary U.S. journalism. Jerry Ianson at Op-Ed News noted that the lies of newsmakers, so-called, can be exposed by the very simple expedient of providing context. What's so difficult about the concept of context? Without it, he says, without measuring statement against background and fact, the so-called news is little more than a firing range. At nearly the same time, another controversy showed the present-day workings of what Chomsky and Herman call the disciplinary and ideological filters at work in the manufacture of consent. A media smear campaign of false accusations of anti-Semitism, organized by former American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, that's APAC for short, spokesman Josh Block, against analysts and journalists at two organizations, Media Matters and the Center for American Progress, or CAP. The story appeared in mid-December 2001, his project appeared to have backfired. He was publicly exposed. He was actually expelled by the Democratic Party-aligned Truman National Security Project, for which he worked, for using mischaracterization or character attacks in order to impede, as they put it, the ability to debate difficult topics freely. So that seemed to be a good outcome. A month later, Glenn Greenwald wrote that the disgusting smear campaign rolled on undeterred. Block's smears against, Greenwald says, mostly young liberal writers at CAP's Think Progress blog and at Media Matters were taken up by Ben Smith at Politico, by Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post, supported by the Simon Wiesenthal Center, by Benjamin Weintel in the Jerusalem Post, quoting the far-right Jerusalem-based NGO Monitor, as well as the Wiesenthal Center, by Daniel Greenfield in David Horowitz's Islamophobic Front Page magazine, by Alana Goodman, who wrote in the New York Post that the Anti-Defamation League and the American Jewish Committee had joined the Wiesenthal Center in, quote, accusing CAP and its staff of publishing anti-Israel, hateful, and toxic anti-Jewish material, unquote. The writers, the offending writers, were fired. Block, meantime, represented himself as a defender of civility. And I think his words are interesting. As a progressive Democrat, I'm convinced that on issues as important as the U.S.-Israeli alliance and the threat posed by Iran's nuclear program, there is no room for uncivil discourse or name-calling like Israel Firster or Likudnik. And policy or political rhetoric that is hostile to Israel or suggests that Iran has no nuclear weapons program has no place in mainstream Democratic Party discourse. I believe that when it occurs, progressive institutions have a responsibility not to tolerate such speech or arguments. And he hopes that going forward, quote, we will see a more civil discourse on these issues from leading progressive institutions. Of course we will, if the people he smears as anti-Semites or pro-Iranian have been purged and silenced. And of course the pious posturing about doing away with hateful or uncivil discourse is unaffected by the fact that as of December 2001, there was no evidence that Iran actually had a nuclear weapons program, or the other fact that in January 2012, as we'll shortly see, U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and Israeli intelligence sources both stated categorically that Iran did not have a nuclear weapons program. It may not come, by the way, as a complete surprise that also in January 2012, Reporters Without Borders, Reporters Sans Frontières, listed the United States in 47th place, tied with Romania and Argentina in its annual ranking of press freedom. Former CIA officer Philip Giraldi's assessment of the present situation is bleak. Quote, no matter how one feels about Iran's government and its ambitions, he wrote in mid-December of last year, everyone should be taking notice of what is happening to fuel the drive to war. The drumbeat is incessant, fed by weekly warnings from leading Israeli politicians and truculent editorials and poorly informed op-eds in leading American newspapers. The American people are being told over and over again that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, that Tehran is threatening U.S. soldiers, and that Ahmadinejad has pledged to wipe Israel off the map. Alluding to a larger scale pattern, Giraldi repeats, quote, as Washington has demonstrated itself unwilling to negotiate with Iran over outstanding issues and has refused every attempt by the Iranians to compromise. And there's one very signal example of that from 2010 that I'd be happy to go into in some detail, perhaps later on. I quote again, there can be only one outcome to the game that is being played, and that is war, unquote. Now, in a more recent essay published on February the 8th, Giraldi analyzes the strategy for ensuring consent that has been adopted by the American government, including the leaders of both political parties, by the Israeli government, by a major part of the corporate media in both countries, as well as by other components of what I'm calling the disciplinary and ideological apparatuses. What do you do, Giraldi asks, if you want a war, but your intelligence services tell you, quote, that Iran does not have a nuclear device and has not made the political decision to build one, unquote? Here's his answer. You shift your narrative and develop a new way of defining the threat. Israel and its friends have consequently initiated a major offensive, both back at home and in the United States, to heighten the impression that Iran poses a genuine threat to Israel, the United States, and even to world peace in general. The new narrative, Giraldi says, goes roughly as follows. Iran is developing a nuclear weapon and is close to having one, despite what those intelligence people think. The weapon will inevitably be used by Iran directly or else given to terrorists to threaten Israel, Europe, and even the United States using ballistic missiles that are currently being developed. Because Iran is concealing or defensively hardening its new nuclear facilities, the window is closing on a military option to destroy the program. Now, to make a preemptive attack doubly necessary, Giraldi adds, this, what he calls, major disinformation strategy involving diplomatic intelligence and media resources, unquote, includes the claim that Iran, quote, is also planning to attack Jewish and American targets worldwide, including inside the United States, unquote. Now, the present situation is complicated by the dynamics of the U.S. presidential election, which include, I think quite interestingly, what Max Blumenthal describes as this is a really excellent article, as a political shadow campaign organized by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the goal of which is, quote, helping the Republicans oust Obama from the White House. The strategy is, of course, to make unconditional support for Israel a wedge issue, representing the president as a weakling whose attempts to evade, quote, the confrontation with evil, you know who that means, may bring a second Holocaust, unquote. Those words, by the way, are not from Netanyahu. They're from Newt Gingrich, Republican candidate. And they're quoted by Blumenthal, and this gives an idea of some of the linkages at work, from a front page spread in the Israeli tabloid Israel Hayom, which he says is referred to Israelis as the Bibiton, or Bibi's mouthpiece, and is one source of his extraordinary political leverage in Israel. Not coincidentally, Blumenthal adds, this newspaper is owned by Las Vegas tycoon Sheldon Adelson, major political contributor to far right-wing causes, who has bankrolled the political careers both of Bibi Netanyahu and of Newt Gingrich. Now, are these maneuverings having any impact? Gene Lyons, writing at Salon.com on February the 8th, thinks so. He took note of what he said, a skeptical observer might be forgiven for suspecting as a well-coordinated propaganda campaign, namely articles appearing concurrently within 24 hours in the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, and Bloomberg News, all of them urging a U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, a matter, as the third article casually puts it, of, quote, some creative destruction. That's that loathsome historian, Neil Ferguson, by the way. I think a really quite seriously despicable person. Or according to the fourth article, attempting to drum up fear, a matter of preventing the possible, quote, obliteration of Israel and its 6 million Jews. That number is, of course, not adventitious. That's a direct allusion to the Shoah. At the outset of the recent round of Republican presidential candidate debates, Rick Santorum declared, quote, anyone who suggests that Iran is not a threat to this country or is not a threat to stability in the Middle East is obviously not seeing the world very clearly. He's seeing it exactly the way that Barack Obama sees it. And here he pointed his finger at fellow Republican candidate Ron Paul. Now, Santorum made an oddly apocalyptic mention of Iran's supposed nuclear weapons aspirations. It's worth sometimes looking at the details of what these people say. Quote, If Rick Santorum, and when Rick Santorum is president, Iran will not get a nuclear weapon because the world as we know it will be no more. Oh dear. Perhaps we don't want this man to get his hands on the little red button. He also, of course, touched on some of the other motifs of the propaganda drumbeat, claiming that Iran, quote, is the greatest supporter of terrorism in the Middle East and around the world, a title that Noam Chomsky has for many decades securely awarded to the United States, of course, and that it's setting up camps and plotting with Venezuela and other countries to the south to attack us. The soft underbelly of the United States, one presumes. One's reminded of Ronald Reagan's dire warnings about Nicaragua being a dagger pointed at the heart of the United States. Nearly direct quotation from Adolf Hitler. Ron Paul, the anti-war candidate against whom this diatribe was aimed, responded, and here I wish I could do a sort of squeaky Ron Paul voice, that Iran does not have an air force that can come here. They can't even make enough gasoline for themselves, and here we are building the case up just like we did in Iraq. Build up the war propaganda. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they had nuclear weapons, and we had to go in. I'm sure you supported that war as well. Rick Santorum, who I've omitted his interruptions. There were two of them in the. Rick Santorum says, yes. Ron Paul continues, it's time we quit this. It's time. It's trillions of dollars we're spending on these wars. The other Republican candidates look on with expressions of pity or contempt. Now, everyone who attends to the corporate news has heard countless times that Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has threatened since October 2005 to, quote, wipe Israel off the map, and that Iran is busily working to produce nuclear weapons to achieve that genocidal goal. Given the tone and temperature of current public discourse, which we've had some samplings of, any attempt to calmly and critically weigh the best evidence on these subjects may seem doomed. Those who hold power in the United States and in Israel appear determined to pursue a course of action of criminal aggression that will predictably lead, in short order, to the violent death of very large numbers of people, the vast majority of them civilians. And we've seen indications of the kinds of smear tactics and defamation deployed by the propagandists of aggression. There's all the more need, then, to insist, as an essential component of democratic citizenship, on what the democracy of ancient Athens called parhesia, the duty of fearless speech that discloses unwelcome truths in the face of opposing power, even at the risk of social sanctions or punishment. A risk which the parhesiastes, the speaker of truth, sets aside as unimportant. Quote, using his freedom, as the philosopher Michel Foucault wrote, and choosing frankness instead of persuasion, truth instead of falsehood or silence. So let's look at some evidence. First, threats against Israel. Some of you may know this already, but I'm going to go into a little bit of detail on that notorious October 2005 speech. I'm going to make use here of a little bit of paraphrase by Arash Nowruzi. Iranian President Ahmadinejad argued, quote, that Zionism is the West's apparatus of political oppression against Muslims and operates, quote, as a strategic bridgehead to ensure American domination of the region and its assets, unquote. Now, by way of demonstrating to his audience that a world without this domination is possible, Ahmadinejad, as a good theocrat, referred to three instances in which the proclamations of the Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of Iranian theocracy, had proved prophetic. The fall of the, quote, corrupt regime of the U.S.-installed Shah of Iran, quote, the dear Imam said that the Shah's regime must go, unquote. Two, the collapse of the supposedly, quote, iron regime of the Soviet Union. Quote, Imam said the rule of the East, USSR, and of the West, US, should be ended, unquote. Three, the destruction of Saddam Hussein's Iraqi dictatorship. Quote, Imam said that Saddam must go and that he would be humiliated in a way that was unprecedented, unquote. To this sequence, Ahmadinejad added a fourth as yet unfulfilled prophecy. And Farsi speakers here will have to excuse my execrable pronunciation of a transcription. Imam goft in regime ish galgare kodz bayad az safaye ruzgar maz shavad. Here's Arash Nuruzi's, was that okay? At least comprehensible. Thank you very much. Arash Nuruzi offers a word-for-word translation, and I've reordered the last few words to conform with English word order. Imam goft, Imam Khomeini said, in regime, this regime, ish galgare, occupying Qods, Jerusalem, bayad, must, mav shavad, vanish from, az safye ruzgar, from the page of time. Imam said, this regime occupying Jerusalem must vanish from the page of time. Noting this sentence's relation to the prior citations of Khomeini, Nuruzi proposed that, quote, Ahmadinejad would seem to be calling for regime change, not war, unquote. Jonathan Steele of The Guardian likewise judged that the sentence is not a military threat and found support in the reference to the fall of the Shah's regime for the view that Ahmadinejad was talking, quote, about regime change, not the end of Israel. As a schoolboy opponent of the Shah in the 1970s, he surely did not favor Iran's removal from the page of time. He just wanted the Shah out. Notice in this speech the repeated use of the word regime. University of Michigan Middle East scholar Juan Ko, who offered a translation identical to Nuruzi's, remarked that the Khomeini quotation, quote, does not imply military action or killing anyone at all, unquote. Now, there's some ironies that emerge from a close examination of this notorious sentence. The first is the fact, as Jonathan Steele noted, that Ahmadinejad misquoted Khomeini, saying page instead of stage of time. As it happens, the Farsi words sane and safe also rhyme. Second irony, Nuruzi remarks that although neither Khomeini nor Ahmadinejad used the word map, nagshe in Farsi, the inflammatory mistranslation, quote, must be wiped off the map, unquote, was first circulated by, of all people, the Islamic Republic News Agency, IRNA, which evidently employs people who know something about idiomatic English, but rather less about the history and connotations of idiomatic expressions. Thirdly, when Ahmadinejad made a similar statement on December 2006, more than a year later, the IRNA, which had by this time, I think, learned its lesson about the importance of careful translation, reported his words, quote, as the Soviet Union disappeared, the Zionist regime will also vanish and humanity will be liberated, unquote. Now, you can see that he's talking about, in effect, it's the same structure of thinking. Here's the irony. The IRNA got it right this time, but the Associated Press promptly and maliciously altered the wording while still sourcing it to the Islamic Republic News Agency, so that Ahmadinejad was now supposed to have said, quote, the Zionist regime will be wiped out soon, the same way the Soviet Union was, unquote. The AP article, Iran, here's the title, Iran President, : Israel will be wiped out, unquote, was echoed on the following day by Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post, which reported that Ahmadinejad had repeated his threat of wiping out Israel. Nuruzi, I think, rightly points to this as an instance of media manipulation and propaganda in action. Now, just by the way, Juan Cole and Arash Nuruzi are anything but partisans of the Iranian regime. Cole has written that he despises, quote, everything Ahmadinejad stands for, not to mention the odious Khomeini who had personal friends of mine killed, unquote. Well, Nuruzi ends his article, I think rather elegantly, by citing a statement of Ahmadinejad to the effect that, quote, history shows us that oppressive and cruel governments do not survive, unquote. by commenting that, quote, with this statement, Ahmadinejad has also projected the outcome of his own backwards regime, which will likewise vanish from the page of time, unquote. Nuruzi's website, by the way, is Mossadegh.com. You can see what he stands for. Secular democratic governance. Now, I had some comments here on the sort of theocratic orientation of Ahmadinejad and some of his stupidities. The fact that the second of the quotations I've referred to was from a speech delivered at a Tehran Holocaust conference, where he rubbed shoulders with people like David Duke. Part of Ahmadinejad's stupidities, they include the fact that he is an intermittent, I would say, Holocaust denier. But it's worth noting, as of course the American press almost never does, that he's actually rather a minor player in the Iranian power structure. Writing in Foreign Affairs, Akbar Ganji says that his name wouldn't even figure among the 100 most important politicians of the last 30 years in Iran. In other words, the role of president is not what it is in a country like the United States. And the policy of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, has consistently been, quote, I'm quoting from another political scientist, that Iran's goal is not the military destruction of the Jewish state or the Jewish people, but the defeat of Zionist ideology and dissolution of Israel through a popular referendum. In Khamenei's own words, this is from 2005, quote, the solution to the issue of Palestine is to hold a referendum with the participation of all native Palestinians, including Muslims, Jews, and Christians, Palestinians who live both inside and outside the occupied territories. Any government that takes power as a result of this referendum will be an acceptable government. And President Ahmadinejad repeated that principle in his speech at Columbia University in September 2007. What we say is that to solve the 60-year problem, we must allow the Palestinian people to decide about its future for itself. We must allow Jewish Palestinians, Muslim Palestinians, and Christian Palestinians to determine their own fate themselves through a free referendum. And you can see, of course, why to politicians like Bibi Netanyahu that kind of notion would be utterly detestable. Because the result would not be a fulfillment of the Zionist project of Eretz Israel, it would be a multicultural, multi-religious democracy. So there's good reason to be skeptical. How am I doing for time? Good reason to be skeptical about the kinds of things that Netanyahu says. Iran is preparing another Holocaust for the Jewish state, unquote. Or about his demand that Ahmadinejad be tried for the crime of inciting genocide. June 2007, by the way, the U.S. House of Representatives took the same position. There were only two congressional representatives who voted against a non-binding resolution asking the UN Security Council to charge Ahmadinejad under the 1948 Genocide Convention for incitement to commit genocide. Can you guess? Dennis Kucinich, yes. And Ron Paul. Kucinich questioned Ahmadinejad's supposed intentions, read alternate translations of his words into the congressional record, and reminded the House of the misinformation and disinformation that had led to the Iraq War. Ron Paul pertinently asked, quote, does anyone believe that dropping nuclear weapons on Iran will not wipe a people off the map? When it is said that nothing, including a nuclear strike, is off the table on Iran, are those who say it not also threatening genocide? I think a very pertinent remark. I think Canadians ought to be skeptical about similar comments coming from our own leaders, what Gerald Kaplan calls the endlessly repeated soundbite of our Foreign Minister John Baird, quote, we believe Iran constitutes the greatest threat to peace and security in the world, and we'll lose our temper with anyone who challenges us. Baird's quite famous for losing his temper. Or similar statements from Stephen Harper. Now, the question of nuclear weapons development. I'm going to skip on a little bit. Here's a quotation from that excellent journalist, Robert Fisk, that I think is relevant. This is from the 25th of January of this year. Quote, "The Israeli president, Shimon Peres, warns us now that Iran is on the cusp of producing a nuclear weapon. Heaven preserve us. Yet we reporters do not mention that Shimon Peres, as Israeli prime minister, said exactly the same thing in 1996. That was 16 years ago. And we do not recall that the current Israeli PM, Benjamin Netanyahu, said in 1992 that Iran would have a nuclear bomb by 1999. That would be 13 years ago. Same old story," unquote. Now, there's of course a distant possibility that the accusers could be right about the existence of a weapons program, but deluded as to its efficiency. You know, perhaps the Iranians are just have been trying to do this for all these years, but not trying very efficiently. But on January 8, 2012, U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, appearing on the CBS program Face the Nation, together with General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, denied categorically that Iran had any nuclear weapons program. 10 days later, on January 18th, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz published a startling report about the presentation that Israeli intelligence would be making to General Dempsey, same guy, during his visit to Israel later that week. Quote, "The intelligent assessment Israeli officials will present later this week to Dempsey indicates that Iran has not yet decided whether to make a nuclear bomb. The Israeli view is that while Iran continues to improve its nuclear capabilities," that's become an interesting catchphrase, "it has not yet decided whether to translate these capabilities into a nuclear weapon, or more specifically, a nuclear weapon mounted atop a missile. Nor is it clear when Iran might make such a decision." Juan Cole, Middle East expert from the University of Michigan, remarked, quote, "This is the same conclusion to which the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies have come in 2007 and 2010. It is also consistent with what the Iranian government itself says, which is that the Iranian nuclear enrichment program is a civilian one and that Iran is not trying to construct a nuclear weapon. Likewise, the International Atomic Energy Agency," which I may have more to say later or perhaps in questions, "which continues to inspect Iranian nuclear facilities, has repeatedly and consistently stated that no nuclear material has been diverted from the civilian program," unquote. You might want to heave a sigh of relief, but don't, not just yet. Let's first consider the very peculiar manner in which Leon Panetta framed his denial of an Iranian nuclear weapons program. The Iranians, he said, need to be pressured, quote, "to join the international family of nations and act in a responsible way." I think the pressure of the sanctions, I think the pressure of diplomatic pressures from everywhere, Europe, United States, elsewhere, is working to put pressure on them, stuck on that word, to make them understand that they can't continue to do what they're doing. Are they trying to develop a nuclear weapon? No. But we know that they're trying to develop a nuclear capability, and that's what concerns us. And our red line to Iran is do not develop a nuclear weapon. That's a red line for us. Is there anyone else to whom this sounds peculiar? I mean, not just rhetorically redundant, but mildly insane. Quote, and this is my paraphrase, if you like, "these people need to be subjected to the pressure of pressures so that they don't continue doing what they're doing or actually not doing." A much younger generation than mine has a code for responding to things like this, WTF, whatever that might mean. I'll pretend not to know. Now, it might be added in parentheses, since I began by talking about media deceptions, that what one might take to be Panetta's key words, quote, "are they trying to develop a nuclear weapon? No," unquote, were edited out of his statement the following evening by PBS anchor Margaret Warner, who on PBS NewsHour reduced it to just this soundbite, quote, But we know they're trying to develop a nuclear capability, and that's what concerns us, unquote. Very clever, eh? Now, Defense Secretary Panetta seems not to be the only person in Washington afflicted with the cognitive bifurcation of wanting to stop people doing what they're not doing. On January 12th, Karen DeYoung and Scott Wilson of the Washington Post quoted an unnamed U.S. intelligence official as saying that, this is the journalist's paraphrase, I guess, quote, the intelligence community stands by its controversial 2007 conclusion that Iranian leaders have not decided whether to build a nuclear bomb, unquote. That seems sane enough, though controversial is presumably the journalist's acknowledgement of the rage of Vice President Dick Cheney and his neocon subordinates at being denied by the 2007 National Intelligence Estimate of their pretext for attacking Iran. But listen to what DeYoung and Wilson then quote as the intelligence official's own words. Quote, our belief is that Iranian leaders are reserving judgment on whether to continue with key steps they haven't taken regarding nuclear weapons, he said. Whether to continue with steps they haven't taken. Okay. Now, that's what I wanted to say about the issue of media deceptions. How am I doing for time? 41. Oh, there's a clock there. I didn't see it. Okay. Which is running an hour fast. It's not yet 10 o'clock, thank goodness. I just want to say some very brief speculative things, or not so speculative, about the economic and political instabilities that make war tempting, both to the United States and to Israel. And I think I can put this very briefly. I'm not referring here to specific texts, though I'll be happy to take questions. The most obvious factor is the economic decline of the United States, the hollowing out of all but its military industrial capacities, growing discontent within the United States. The Occupy Wall Street protests, which spread across the nation, are one sign of that. And a fear of great power competition with the rise of China and the at least partial resurgence of Russia. Russia in a primarily military capacity, China, of course, as the major coming economic superpower, and also, in recent years, the second largest spender in the world on military hardware. Now, I think we can take as a general principle that empires in decline are tempted to military action that they might otherwise recognize as rash. There's also a large question of energy geopolitics, which I'll speak of in the final section of what I want to say. Now, with regard to Israel, it's a different situation, and it's a situation, I think, of what one could call the aporia, a Greek word for blind alley or dead end or blocked movement forward, of the Zionist project. One sign of this is the current balance of inflow and outflow of people into and from Israel. Emigration has for some years apparently exceeded immigration. But the principal issue, I think, is a very naked choice that has been spoken of with surprising openness by a significant number of major Israeli politicians, including Olmert, the previous prime minister, and many others. And it's a choice between attempts to fulfill the Zionist project of Eretz Israel, which, as Olmert and many others recognize, leads into a loss of what Israel has in democracy, leads to a non-democratic future, to a future of apartheid, and a future of appalling conflicts and conflagrations, which I think could be summed up in what is to me, I think, a quite obvious fact, that the fulfillment of that project means a repetition and the completion of the Nakba. It means ethnic cleansing. It means the kind of thing that some of the politicians in Netanyahu's government, most notoriously Lieberman, Avigdor Lieberman, have openly spoken of. Lieberman, back when he was transportation minister, was all for taking the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and drowning them in the Sea of Galilee. He said, I'm transportation minister, I'll provide the buses. There's this horrendous kind of chutzpah willingness to speak of things that one would think arouse immediate echoes of the Shoah. Or another Israeli government minister who threatened the Palestinians with an even greater Shoah, actually used the word. So there's been discursively a kind of step beyond the boundaries of what would previously have been taken to be forbidden. That's what was done to us 60 and more years ago. That's what Nazis do. The idea that people are now people in positions of government, as opposed to complete fringe fanatics, are willing to deploy that sort of rhetoric is profoundly disquieting. And it does suggest that a portion of elite opinion within Israel has already made that choice. Yes, this is what the project involves. And they're willing to go forward. Now, of course, the other alternative is that of an equitable partitioning of Palestine. Well, there are two alternatives. I suppose one would be a one-state solution, which is actually, and ironically, exactly what the Ayatollah Khamenei is recommending. Right? Get all these people together. Jews, Muslims, Christians, they all live in Palestine. They're all Palestinians, as far as he's concerned. Let them vote freely and without... Now, that is anathema, of course, to those who insist on an ethnic state. And here's part of the sort of aporetic dead-end problem. That is, the notion of ethnic states, I mean, it resurfaced in the Yugoslav Civil War in a horrible way, but that is an inheritance from a loathsome 19th century discourse of racist and ethnic nationalism. So there's the possibility of, if you like, a one-state solution, or the other possibility, which now appears to be effectively extinct in the opinion of many commentators in Israel and elsewhere, the two-state solution. How can you achieve such a solution when you have well over 500,000 people settled in apartheid colonies within the occupied territories? How do you get them out? Shy of a civil war. Now, that I think is one of the central issues that is impelling this current situation, that is impelling an extremist politician like Netanyahu to intervene with daring openness in the American presidential electoral process on the side of people who are as fanatical as he is. People like Gingrich, who, as you may be aware, has recently declared that there's no such thing as Palestinian people. Going back to the kind of fraudulent, long exploded notions of propaganda, you know, a people without a land for a land without a people. How did these Palestinians get it? Well, we made things so green and flourishing that they just flocked in from other places, and now somehow we have to get rid of these recent immigrants. Behind that, of course, is the I think fascinating and truly appalling irony that it appears, when one steps beyond mythography into historiography, that a very large proportion of the Palestinian people, i.e. non-Jewish Palestinian people, share the ancestry or are descended from the ancient Jewish people who inhabited that country at the time of the Romans. And by an equal irony, that a proportion at least of the population that came into what is now Israel, beginning with the rise of Zionism in the late 19th century, and of course impelled by the consequences of the Shoah, that some of those people are descended from other peoples, the Khazars, the Berbers, and so on, who have no ancestral connection. Now that doesn't alter the depth of a connection, but it is one would hope one reason for recognizing kinship, recognizing brotherhood and sisterhood. Whether that can happen, I don't know, but there are obviously Israeli historians who are working to spread an understanding of that. Now, I want to say something briefly about likely plans of attack and defense. And the first thing to say is that what we're looking at is, I think, a long-term project within the American state apparatus of regime change. Changing the direction of any form of sort of state decision-making that's already implanted in reports and the thinking of many people and so on is a little bit like changing the direction of an ocean liner. You can put the helm hard over, 25 degrees over, and the engine's full astern, and the bloody thing just keeps on going. I had a little bit of experience in smaller ships in my youth. Changing the direction of a destroyer takes a surprising amount of time. You put the helm over hard, and it keeps going for the length of a couple of football fields before anything happens. So here we have a long implanted set of state policies that go back at least until that period of the captivity of the embassy staff in Tehran, the American embassy staff, the American horror with the fall of the Shah of Iran, who had been one of their major kind of geopolitical subordinates, keeping the Middle East in order. Now, I say that this project has a kind of inexorability because in 2010, President Obama raised what he thought was a bar that was higher than the Iranians would even dream of jumping over. He said, "Look, if you make an agreement with Brazil." And with, Lord, who else was it? Sorry, can someone help me here? Turkey, thank you. With Turkey and Brazil, so that they are involved in the process of the nuclear fuel cycle. In other words, so that we can have an assurance that you're not diverting this stuff into weapons. And to his, I think, shock and astonishment, the Iranians got together with the Turks, and they got together with the Brazilians, and they came up with a solution. All three states agreed. Whereupon the Americans simply raised the bar higher. And I think that was one clear sign, and with indignant propaganda about how these Iranians are just impossible to deal with. They keep saying yes. Now, I think that was one very clear sign that when Obama or when European politicians talk about, why can't we get these people to the table? Well, the Iranians agreed to a confidence-building interval of 2 years in which, in conversation with the three, France, Germany, and the United Kingdom, they would try and sort of, with the Europeans working as intermediaries, they would try and work out a solution. And what they found is the Europeans were simply serving as conduits for their, in effect, instructions from Washington. And the instructions were very clearly, don't let anything be solved. And after 2 years, the Iranians said, sorry, we're restarting. And that was represented publicly as, another horrifying example of aggressiveness and intransigence. Now, in other words, there is a long-term plan of regime change, and there's also a long-term plan of active involvement with potential agents of regime change, including that bizarre organization, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, and also other organizations, notably the Jundala. Both of these are terrorist organizations. They plant bombs. The Mujahideen-e-Khalq were responsible quite some time ago for a highly successful attack that killed, I think, over 70 members of the Iranian parliament. And by the way, there's been recent revelations in the news that the operations of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq were used by the Israelis for their attacks on Iranian scientists. Now, that is quite clearly terrorism. Although it's not considered such in the American press. That's interesting, right? That ludicrous, obviously, almost childishly confected case of a used car dealer who got in touch with Mexican gangs to supposedly assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States. That was described as terrorism. But when American intelligence officials tell NBC, as they did either today or yesterday, that yes, the Israelis used the Mujahideen, the MEK, to carry out and train them to carry out these attacks, in other words, confirming what the Iranian government has said about the documents they possess and the confessions they've obtained from one person who was captured. At the same time, there have been recent reports, again within the last week or two, that the CIA is very annoyed with the Israelis for impersonating CIA officers and recruiting Jundala people, again, for much the same purposes. Now, at the same time as we get these reports, we also have President Obama making bizarre statements using metaphors like the United States remaining in lockstep with Israel. And I think we have to understand that kind of statement in relation to what I said earlier about the American presidential election campaign. He's clearly responding to what he and his advisors feel to be the kind of exigencies of the campaign, without a whole lot of concern for the fact that that gives his primary alien enemy, if you like, Netanyahu, a completely free hand to drag the United States into a war that could be militarily disastrous. Militarily disastrous because what the Iranians have been developing is something that American defense analysts call anti-access and area denial strategies. That's A2 and AD. They love these little, you know, contractions. A2 and AD, that's what them Iranians are doing. And it's something that the Chinese have done. And they've what we're facing in sort of military naval terms is in some ways analogous to what happened to the battleship in World War II. The battleship was discovered to be obsolete. When the British sent two of their best ships into the areas being attacked by Japan in 1941, and they were almost instantly destroyed by Japanese air power. That was a clear sign. The destruction of the Bismarck was another one. The destruction of the Japanese battleship Yamato, again by air power. Well, the current obsolescence, I think, may have to do with giant floating airfields, aircraft carriers. They're effectively obsolete in relation to the missiles developed by Russian scientists since the 1980s. One of them goes by the NATO code name of Sunburn. A variant of it was co-developed between Russia and India. It's known as the BrahMos. The Indian Navy possesses it. It's a missile. If you think of what happened in the Falkland Islands, do you remember the exocets that destroyed some British ships? Although flown, delivered by antiquated jet aircraft, flown by extremely courageous Argentinian pilots, they managed to do very large damage. Those were sub-speed of sound. The Sunburn missiles travel at something in excess of 2.5 times the speed of sound. They're capable of maneuvering. They can be fired in salvos. The consensus among American naval experts seems to be that they have no answer to these things, meaning that the American Navy cannot repeat the kind of saber rattling it carried out in the late 1990s in the Taiwan Strait, for example, because the Chinese have got these missiles both on ships that the Russians sold them, two Sovremenny-class destroyers equipped with Sunburns, and in shore batteries. So anti-ship missiles with a range of something like approaching 200 miles, or perhaps even more in the later variants. The Iranians, I don't believe, possess those. What they have are earlier, in effect, obsolete ship-to-ship, shore-to-ship missiles, which nonetheless, in the confined spaces of the Persian Gulf, could be deadly to American naval units. The Iranians have super quiet diesel-powered submarines, which are hard to detect. They have swarm tactics, which were deployed by an American general in a large war game played by the United States in 2002, in which, to everyone's surprise, the enemy won. The guy who was playing the Iranians, they were given some cockeyed name so that, you know, we wouldn't think this was aggressive, used swarm tactics involving small ship attacks and so on and so on, and they started the game again and said, okay, we're going to exclude those tactics because the good guys have to win. In other words, I don't want to make rash predictions because the preponderance of American air power, of American missile power, Israeli air power, Israeli missile power, and the naval power that could be exerted by America and its allies, who might include Canada, is overwhelming. One key question is, could Iran succeed in closing off the Straits of Hormuz? For about 100 kilometers, there are passages that are, in many cases, well under 30 kilometers in width, with narrow shipping lanes within that distance. Therefore, vulnerable to missile, small craft, and other kinds of attack. Could Iran close the Straits of Hormuz? Yes. For how long? That's a very difficult question, which I wouldn't venture to answer. What that would mean is closing off the pipeline, in effect, seagoing pipeline, through which in 2008, 40%, more recently down to about 33% of the world's shipborne oil passed. 17% of all oil sent across borders in the world passes through that strait. So the economic impact would be gigantic. And what President Obama faces quite clearly is another kind of aporia. On the one hand, he's got political opponents who, with the sole exception of Ron Paul, are trying to paint him as the weakling who will allow these genocidal people to have their bomb and threaten Israel, and threaten the rest of the world, of course. Or he's facing the possibility of a military action that could create gigantic and possibly long-term economic consequences. And that are, of course, uncontrollable in the consequences, because an attack on Iran would almost inescapably involve counter-attacks both against American forces and against Israeli forces and against Gulf states which allowed their territory to be used for aerial attacks on Iran. Hezbollah would be drawn in, almost certainly, which would mean Israel involved in another war against Lebanon. There are various scenarios that have been sketched out by people, including former CIA agent Philip Giraldi, whom I quoted before, which could involve things like the reigniting of tensions between India and Pakistan, could involve the drawing in of other states as well. And this is a very interesting question. I'm moving now to the last issue of geopolitics. Because part of what the United States is engaged in is a long-term geopolitical project that was enunciated in the late 1990s by, for example, the Silk Road strategy approved by Congress, which was a strategy of, in effect, moving into Central Asia, the old Silk Road, playing the great game, in effect. The project for a new American century strategy, announced in 2000 by people who subsequently became the mainstay of the George W. Bush government. Or since it was never elected or re-elected, I would say the George W. Bush regime. Now, what do these strategies involve? Well, they involve, among other things, a recognition that a very high proportion of the major energy reserves of the globe are contained in the Middle East and in Western Asia, Caspian Basin, Iran, and so on. Iran, although it had a first peak of oil production as early as 1974, 6.1 million barrels, it rose, I think, to decline during the revolution period, declined through the 70s. It's now back to about half what it was at its first peak. That, of course, is one reason the Iranians have said they want civil nuclear power. Because their oil has either peaked or will peak, definitively, and it will then be in decline. And as it becomes increasingly precious, do you want to burn it as gasoline or as fuel to supply electrical plants, or can you do something else? Now, whether post-Fukushima that's a good idea or not is another question, but that at least is the thinking. Now, two aspects of the geopolitics include other major nuclear powers. First, Russia, which after the catastrophic decline it experienced following the collapse of the Soviet Union, the decay of Russia's economic and military power, has undergone, at least militarily, a kind of resurgence. The United States has been behaving in a very provocative manner, building what are clearly, by any military analyst's understanding, first strike capability radar facilities in Poland right next to Russia. And trying to say, oh, these are to protect us from those Iranians. I mean, the Russians are not, they weren't born yesterday. So it may be in response to that the Russians have been a little more willing to allow some of their missile technology to be disseminated elsewhere. The Sunburn missiles to China, which is a major geopolitical blow to the United States, to India. The S-300 anti-aircraft missiles to Iran. Iran now has them. Whether they're in quantity or deployed yet, I don't know. But those missiles, which are not quite the S-400 is the current sort of generation used by the Russians. The S-300, though, is a highly capable missile air defense system, which would make air war against Iran, if they were fully deployed, a much tougher proposition than it currently is. And finally, of course, I think most crucially, there's the question of the petrodollar economy. Now, in February 2006, I published an article on what then appeared to be the oncoming war with Iran. Because there was a real crescendo of drumbeats, and it appeared to be connected to the fact that Iran had announced that it was going to form a Tehran oil bourse that would trade oil and natural gas not in US dollars, but in euros or other currencies. And that is a mortal threat to the American geopolitical economic system. The U.S. dollar as fiat currency is basically what supports the military might of the U.S. empire. Were other countries There already are, in fact. There's a lot of bilateral trading that's now going on in renminbi and in other currencies between countries. Iran is now trading oil in basically any currency other than dollars. Saddam Hussein in 2000 announced that he was going to trade his oil in euros rather than in US dollars. And by some analysts thinking that was a part of what prompted the American decision no longer simply to choke the Iranians with murderous sanctions, but to invade. The final part of the geopolitical issue is, of course, the fact that a hold on those Middle Eastern and Western Asian oil supplies would give the United States very significant leverage in relation to China. So there are the possibilities. And one can see this in the Security Council votes. Right? For example, over Syria, a horrendous regime, which is also, in addition to being horrendous, being subjected, I believe, not just to the revolt of a disgusted and sick of all that crap population, but also to the work of the regime change operations of the United States and other countries. Russia and China are refusing to go along with the rest of the Security Council on this. And I think the reasons are quite clearly a measure of their geopolitical interests. Now, I'm going to conclude. I'm sorry, I've gone on longer than I should have. I'm going to conclude simply with a reference to a curious fact that one of the inscriptions in the entrance to the United Nations building in New York, as many of you know, is a quotation from the Farsi classic Gulistan, and it's there because it's an expression of common humanity. It's I'm not going to quote it. It's a very simple and resonant statement of human solidarity, of human brotherhood, and of what we have in common. And I think it's that kind of ideal that we need to hold in mind when we look at the totality of this situation. When we look first at the media deceptions, when we look at what I take to be the contemptible position taken by our own government on these issues, and when we look at the very serious and I think pressing dangers that are facing not merely the people of Tehran and the rest of Iran, whom we saw so interestingly engaged with by Raghed Omar in the film clip that Michael edited for us, but that risk a conflagration that goes further in all directions. Many people in Israel could see their lives destroyed by such a conflagration. Many people in other countries throughout the Middle East. Should nuclear weapons be used, and I mean here not just the nuclear weaponry of depleted uranium that has been already used in four or five wars, but nuclear bombs, then a major threshold will have been crossed. And when politicians say everything is on the table, it's the crossing of that threshold that they're envisaging. So I think we need to do all that we can in exercising that ancient Greek duty of fearless speech, of parhesia. We call it, more often than not, speaking truth to power. But we need it. We need lots of it. And thank you for being here. Sorry, I went on so long.
It's wonderful. We have to be out of here by 10. I'd like to have a few questions, and I'm hoping what we can do is maybe Michael can pick several people to just ask fast questions, and he can answer with just one answer that kind of covers it. We should maybe 10 more minutes. Is that okay with you, Michael?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, if there are people that have some questions, they can maybe ask them briefly, and we'll ask them and answer them. By the way, while I'm just up here, this is the eighth year of this programming.